You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. I want to tell you about a great new podcast called Outside the Box. If you're a maker, an innovator, or even just a consumer who wants to peek behind the curtain of some of the world's greatest organizations, you'll love it. The latest episode features interviews with the visionaries who are creating systems that bring our work, and more importantly, our workforce, into the 21st century. Because although we're plugged in at home, when it comes to the workforce, we're lagging behind. Listen to Outside the Box in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. Well, folks, I've had the great Carl Reiner on the show a couple of times now, most recently in June, so it was only a matter of time before I had his son, the talented director, actor, and writer Rob Reiner on the podcast. Rob Reiner certainly needs no introduction. Coming from an entertainment family, Reiner's earliest television credits go back as far as The Andy Griffith Show, Gomer Pyle, The Beverly Hillbillies, and The Partridge Family. But his best-known role remains his 9-season run on All in the Family as Michael, or Meathead, as Archie Bunker used to call him. He's also had many memorable roles on the big screen, including This is Spinal Tap, Throw Mama from the Train, Postcards from the Edge, Sleepless in Seattle, Bullets Over Broadway, The First Wives Club, Primary Colors, Ed TV, The Muse, The Majestic, The Wolf of Wall Street, and most recently in the Adam Sandler film Sandy Wexler. He's directed no less than 20 movies, including some of the most beloved films of the past 3 decades, like This is Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men, North, The American President, Ghosts of Mississippi, The Story of Us, Rumor Has It, and The Bucket List. Reiner is also no stranger to the world of politics. He was the co-founder of the American Foundation for Equal Rights, which initiated the court challenge against Prop 8, which banned same-sex marriage in California. In 1998, Reiner chaired the campaign to pass Prop 10, the California Children and Families Initiative, which created First 5 California, a program of early childhood development services. Reiner is a member of the Social Responsibility Task Force, an organization advocating moderation where social issues and the entertainment industry meet. He's also active in environmental issues, and he successfully led the effort to establish California's Amundsen Ranch as a state park and wildlife refuge rather than a commercial real estate development. Reiner came close to running against California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2006, and he's campaigned and endorsed Democratic presidential candidates including Al Gore, Howard Dean, and Hillary Clinton. Now Rob Reiner is melding his politics with his art in his newest film, LBJ, which stars Woody Harrelson as President Lyndon Johnson. And today, we'll talk about how Reiner's view of LBJ has evolved since he was a young man of draft age during the Vietnam War. We'll talk about what drove Johnson to become a champion for civil rights. We'll recall a few of the more memorable LBJ anecdotes and speculate on how the famously politically incorrect president might have fared in the age of iPhones and social media. He'll weigh in on the Trump-Russia investigation, the failed health care bill, and the divisiveness of today's political climate. Plus, he'll talk about growing up in show business, the time he got in trouble for grabbing Mary Tyler's ass on the set of his dad's show, his audition for All in the Family, and whether or not he could get used to the words President Meathead. Coming up with Rob Reiner in just a moment. My guest today has been nominated for 9 Golden Globes, 3 Directors Guild Awards, an Academy Award, and 5 Emmys, 2 of which he won, along with the People's Choice Award. He's well known on screen as Archie Bunker's bleeding heart son-in-law, Michael Meathead Stivic, in All in the Family. And I can see that you're cringing as I bring that up.
No. I wasn't cringing at that so much. I was cringing at the fact that I've been nominated for all these things and I hardly win anything. I've only won 2 things. So that was the thing that was most upsetting. No, the Meathead thing is fine. I mean, you're only the 3rd person to call me that today.
Yeah, sure.
So you should feel honored.
Well, aside from All in the Family, you had memorable roles in Throw Mama from the Train, Sleepless in Seattle, Bullets Over Broadway, The First Wives Club, Primary Colors, New Girl, and The Wolf of Wall Street. My guest's body of work as a director has included such a diverse range of hits as This Is Spinal Tap, Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally, Misery, A Few Good Men, North, The American President, Ghosts of Mississippi, Rumor Has It, The Bucket List, and his newest film, LBJ. Oh, and on occasion, he has a political opinion or two. Rob Reiner, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. You know, you list all that stuff, and now I'm exhausted.
Well, you know, you must not have your dad's genes, because I had him on, I guess, about a month ago for the second time, and my God, 95,
he keeps going. He's 95. I actually do have his genes, and unfortunately, they don't fit. They don't fit. I'm a lot bigger than he is, so I'll have to lose some weight if I want to really have his genes.
Well, I'm amazed by
your dad.
It's
maybe the worst joke I've ever made in my life. Although, you know, you stick with me a while, and it could get worse.
Do you think you'll have his stamina at that age?
Oh, God. You know, I can't imagine. I mean, the guy's 95 years old. He gets up every day. It's like he makes the joke. You know, I read the obits, and if I'm not in it, I eat breakfast. And he writes. He writes every single day. He's written like 5 books in the last 5 years. And I can't imagine, you know, having the kind of stamina. I remember when I was little. And he was on the show of shows, Sid Caesar's show. He was he was already well known at that point. And we'd be walking down the street in New York City, and I was always having to run to keep up with him.
Really?
You know, yeah, his pace was so fast. I mean, I would have to sprint. So it's the same. You know, I'd be lucky to make it that far.
Well, he told me that you and Albert Brooks were childhood best friends.
Yeah.
And I guess you guys used to do these little comedy routines for the family, ironically, as the team of Reiner and Brooks.
Well, we actually, it was Albert who used to do the routine. I mean,
okay.
Yes, here's what's funny. My father's best friend is Mel Brooks. And as a kid growing up, my best friend was Albert Brooks. And now my son, Nick Reiner, his best friend is Joey Brooks, who is Jim Brooks's son. So you got 3 generations of Reiners and Brookses.
Now, are you still close with Albert?
Yeah, I still see Albert. Yeah, I still see him once in a while. We talk. We have dinner once in a while. Yeah, he's literally the funniest man I know.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, Mel too.
Yeah.
Mel too. I would say both those Brookses, and neither of them is that their real name. I mean, all 3 Brookses, actually. Jim, Albert, and...
Oh, that's right.
Mel is...
Mel was Melvin Kaminsky, right?
Mel Kaminsky. Yeah. Jim Brooks is Jim Bernstein, I think.
Yeah.
And Albert is Albert Einstein. I am not kidding.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
At some point, I think I heard Mel's son...
Max?
Max. It said that your dad and his dad have this routine where Mel comes over to your dad's house every night. And basically they yell at each other and have dinner till 3 in the morning.
They do that, and they watch some television show, and they'll have something to eat, and Mel will fall asleep on the couch a lot of the time. And, it's nice that they have each other.
Well, I wonder, coming from such a great showbiz family, when you decided to go into entertainment, Did you ever try to work the nepotism angle, or did Dad have advice for you?
No. The nepotism thing doesn't, you know, it's there. I mean, it's not, listen, the name is there. The nepotism part, we never did any of that stuff. I mean, he never tried to help out in that way, but I think that was good. I mean, I had to cut my own teeth and make my own way. But I definitely was aware of how, you know, the shadow and all of that. And they tell the story about when I was 8 years old, I went up to my mother and I said, I want to change my name. And she told my dad was all upset. He was worried, you know, that how is this poor kid feels the burden of having to live up to, you know, the name and all this. So he came to me, he says, well, I hear you want to change your name. What do you want to change it to? And I said, Carl. So, you know, I thought that I could get right there. I didn't have to. Yeah.
That's great. Well, was he pretty encouraging, or did he try to talk you out of it?
No, he wasn't encouraging or discouraging. Mm-hmm. He basically just let me go my own way, and, you know, I found my own way. But I was always interested. I mean, he let me, when I was a teenager, he let me come down to the set to watch the Van Dyke show during the day. I mean, when it was, I was off for school in the summers, and I spent every single day on the set of the Dick Van Dyke show. So I was curious about it. I wanted to know about it.
Yeah, you were curious about a lot of things, because I heard this story that when you were a kid on the set, you grabbed Mary Tyler Moore's ass.
Yes,
and got
I did.
In some trouble. Huh?
I did. I was 14 years old, and I'm not telling tales out of school because she talks about it in her book, and she actually mentioned it on the Letterman show. So she was a great lady. And here's an interesting thing, because she was so beautiful, and I was 14. She was like 25 years old. She wore these capri pants, and my hormones were going crazy. I don't know, you know, I grabbed her. My dad called me she told on me, you know, and my dad called me in the office and said, did you grab Mary Tyler Moore by the ass? I said, yeah, I did. And he said, well, he had a smile on his face, actually, when he said it. He said, don't ever do that again. Okay, so here's the flash forward on this, and this is you'd have to know the show, because she would always get crying as you go, oh, Rob,
right.
You know, like that.
Oh, Rob.
Yeah, that was the thing. And so years later, they were doing a reunion show, the Van Dyke show, and I came down to visit. Now I had been successful, All in the Family, had made movies and stuff like that. And they had just finished a scene where they were in she was in an evening gown, Dick was in a tuxedo. They finished the scene, and I told the guy, just keep rolling the camera. So I walked on, and I stopped her. You know, I said, Mary, I just want to say I'm really sorry for what I did back then. I didn't know what came over me. I'm so sorry. I just feel bad. And she says, it's okay. I said, listen, you were so beautiful. I said, listen, if I wouldn't get arrested for sexual harassment, I mean, even now you're so gorgeous. She sticks her tush out right at me, and I grab her, and she goes, oh, Rob. It was like a 30-year setup to a great punch.
Well, I wonder, how did you get the part on All in the Family?
Well, that
go way back.
Is interesting, because they did two pilots at ABC, and they had two different sets of Mike and Gloria's. They were two different sets of actors. And I actually auditioned for one of the times at ABC. I didn't get the part. And then they went to CBS, and I came back again. And at this point, I think I had gotten a little better, and then I auditioned again, and I got it that time.
You started out as an actor. When did you start to think that you might want to also kind of follow your dad's footsteps into directing?
Well, I did start as an actor, but not really. I started as an actor and a director. I was 19 years old, and I started my own improv group with some friends at UCLA, and I was directing the group as well. And I had directed some theater in L.A. when I was 19. I did a production of No Exit. Then Rick Dreyfuss was the star of that. And, you know, so I had done things as a director even when I was young and 19.
Well, your body of work as a filmmaker, as I already mentioned, is so diverse, ranging from Spinal Tap to Princess Bride to Misery, A Few Good Men, and now LBJ. Is it a matter of you want to challenge yourself as a director by experimenting in so many different genres, or is there a consistent element that attracts you to each film?
I don't really think about it in terms of challenging myself from a genre standpoint. Mm-hmm. I'll challenge myself in terms of the story I want to tell, but I usually have to have some kind of connection to it or some feeling about why to tell that story, whether it's a personal one, an emotional connection, or something that I've been thinking about over a period of time, like LBJ. I mean, this is a person who, you know, a president who loomed very large in my life. I was of draft age during the Vietnam War, so he was like my enemy. I hated him because he could send me to my death to a war that I didn't, you know, I wasn't supportive of and thought it was immoral and illegal. And over the years, as I have gotten older and spent some time in politics and in government and working on public policy, I started to have a greater understanding of what he, what his accomplishments meant and how difficult what he was able to do and how amazing his accomplishments were. And so it made me think, okay, I will wrestle with this, you know, because I had an emotional connection to it because of the Vietnam War, but then I also had this other experiential connection over a period of time. So that's what drew me to that. But every film is different, you know, and what draws me to it. There used to be, there has to be some element of connection that I make to it.
You probably came of voting age and of draft age probably toward the end of his presidency, right? I have my math right.
Well, it was 1968. He didn't run. He stayed president through 68, he didn't run. And that was the first year I could vote, because I was born in 47, so I was 21 then. But I was of draft age during the Vietnam, you know, during, you know, 64, 5, 6, you know, when he first won the presidency after Kennedy was assassinated. I was in college and, you know, and I was worried after if I dropped out or what would happen and I'd get, you know, get drafted, because there was a draft then.
Yeah.
And it was a huge anti-war movement. You always say, well, why aren't kids as energized or engaged? Well, you'll get engaged if you think your life is on the line, you know? Yeah. And that's why you're seeing so much activity for the healthcare bill and why when they took it away, they wanted to take it away because people's lives were going to be affected. You're going to lose your healthcare coverage. I mean, that's the thing that gets you motivated. So your life's on the line. Fear, absolutely.
Fear motivates.
Yeah.
Well, you and LBJ certainly are two different kinds of Democrats. I mean, you're a liberal progressive from Hollywood. He was, I guess, what we would call a blue dog Democrat from Texas. Looking back now, do you find much common cause with Lyndon Johnson?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lyndon Johnson came into the United States Congress when FDR was still president. And he idolized FDR. He voted for everything FDR put forward. And the legislation that Lyndon Johnson passed, I mean, when you look at it, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, the litany is, it's incredible. I mean, it's incredible what he was, and those are all things that I support. So, I mean, legislatively, I was, you know, totally in sync with him. What I didn't agree with him was the Vietnam War.
You mentioned the Civil Rights Bill, and certainly LBJ is kind of a complex character because on the one hand, here's a guy who would throw around the N-word when he was talking with his Southern colleagues in the Senate, and yet he risked all the political capital that he had to push through certainly the most important civil rights legislation of the 20th century. What do you think drove him to take up this cause?
I think that at his core, he was not a racist. Mm-hmm. He was from the South, and he was raised in that atmosphere, but he was also raised in the West Texas Hill Country. And he knew poverty. He was of poverty. He came from a very, you know, modest background, and he understood poverty. So he was never ideologically a racist, but he also knew what it took to get elected and to get legislation passed. So he did whatever he did. And like you said, he would say the N-word when he was around certain people, and when he wasn't, he'd try to say, you know, we have a scene in the movie where he says, I'm the only one that can speak Southern and Kennedy. You know, he viewed himself as somebody who could, you know, wrangle people and put people together. Yeah. And he was a master at legislating.
Yeah, he was the consummate horse trader, the master of the backroom deal and so forth.
But you have to want to get that thing done.
Right.
It's not just a matter of effectuating legislation. You have to have in your core at some place to say, I ideal. I want to get this done. This is something I think is important for the country. And then you take those skills that you have, those abilities to wrangle and horse trade. But you don't do it based on nothing. It has to be based on, and he knew full well that he was going to lose the South, that the Democrats would lose the South for, as he thought, a generation. It's Which now over 50 years.
Yeah.
It's more than
more
a generation.
Than that,
yeah, way more. Over 50 years, he's still, it's still gone to the Republicans.
Yeah, and you know, as someone who's very much a Washington insider, master of the backroom deal, I wonder how this film will be received by the public, which seems to be super anti-establishment, anti-Washington these days. One has to think that a guy like that would probably have been tarred and feathered rather than reelected these days.
I don't know about that. I think what you're starting to see with the demise of the health care bill, you're starting to see the beginnings of reconnecting regular order. Mm-hmm. When you saw John McCain take the floor of the Senate and he voted to proceed with the for a motion to proceed, but then he voted against the health care because he said this is not regular order. This is not about bringing both sides together and figuring out how to work together. And you're now seeing small pockets of people that are starting to recognize that. This is a very interesting film to look at with Trump in the White House. I made it over a year ago, and when we first started screening it, it was different. You know, the film is exactly the same film, but recently seeing it after Trump has become president and watching it through that through that lens, it's a different film. People see what a president really is.
Yeah.
This is a real president, not one who plays one on television. He is a real president and how real presidents do things. And I think it'll be eye-opening for them.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Rob Reiner when we come back in just a moment. Kick-Ass News is brought to you by Michael Moore's world premiere Broadway show, The Terms of My Surrender. The Oscar-winning filmmaker behind Bowling for Columbine and Fahrenheit 9/11 invites you on a whirlwind tour through the depraved new world we've found ourselves in since Election Day 2016. Directed by Tony Award winner Michael Mayer, The Terms of My Surrender is a hysterical, heartfelt, and subversive piece of theater that'll help make sense of how the hell we got here and how we can get out. Featuring razor-sharp political insights, up-to-the-minute translations of each day's fresh insanity, and any number of nightly surprises, this outrageous live event is as unpredictable as our current commander-in-chief. Everyone's welcome, Democrats, Republicans, Canadians, and anyone else who believes in free expression for all. So don't miss this once-in-a-lifetime experience with one of American politics' most incisive and hilarious voices. After all, who better to answer the burning questions of the Trumpian era than the man who saw it all coming and tried to warn us? Michael Moore's The Terms of My Surrender, on Broadway for a strictly limited engagement. Visit MichaelMooreOnBroadway.com for more info. And now, back to the show. I mean, here we are 6 months into the Trump presidency, and really the only silver lining seems to be that he's basically had the most impotent administration in modern memory. I mean, Republicans have control of essentially the entire government, and yet they can't seem to turn a single campaign promise of his into actual legislation. The substance of that policy aside, maybe there's something to be said for having an old-fashioned political horse trader who can actually make things happen again.
Well, that's part of it. But it also, you have to understand, you're dealing with a man who has absolutely no core beliefs and has absolutely no ideology. His only core belief is himself. And so there is no passion about the things he wants to do. It's only about what is expedient for him. I would argue that political orthodoxy for Republicans is global trade policy.
Right.
And so that's not something that Republicans are keen on ripping up NAFTA or ripping up
traditional Republicans.
Yes. Well, I mean,
and many of them have fled away from Trump, like Bill Kristol.
Yeah. Well, many of the thoughtful Republicans, they don't, border security is important, but they don't want that wall. That wall is not something they want. And so, yes, they want to repeal and replace Obamacare. They've been saying that for 7 years, but I think a lot of that comes from the extreme right of the party, some of these Tea Party people who don't really understand about how people live in America. Most of the people that they are saying they're representing are dying to have Medicaid. They love Medicaid. They love Obamacare because it expands Medicaid. They're not against that. These people are just connecting to what they think is a small section of their base that's holding them hostage. And so none of the things that Trump is in favor of are they for. The perfect example is he's soft on Russia. Why is he soft on Russia? Well, we pretty much know why. But that's the important thing to know is the Senate, either 97 or 98 to 2, passed a bill saying we're going to be strong on Russia. We're going to be strong on North Korea and Iran. The House, overwhelmingly, with only three votes against, passed the same thing. So they're not in favor of what Trump wants, which is to lift sanctions on Russia. There's nothing that he is putting forward except for maybe deregulation. They like the idea of deregulation.
Well, yeah, and it's strange to see that the public, at least 50% of the country, seems to be completely unfazed by this Russia scandal. I mean, you know, if you think back to LBJ during the Cold War, the very idea that anyone in his White House would have had any kind of collusion with the Soviets or that they would have interfered in a U.S. election.
Well, you know why? Here's why. Because in the Cold War, and this is an ad that only ran one time when LBJ ran against Goldwater, they had a bomb, an atom bomb blowing up. And they said, is this the man you want to entrust, meaning Goldwater, with his finger on the button? That was an enormous, powerful ad that basically, in very clear terms, showed the public what we were dealing with. What we're dealing with now is way, way more destructive than dropping an atom bomb. If the Russians had dropped an atom bomb on New York City, just like when those planes went into the World Trade Center, everybody united. People have a hard time understanding that what Russia was able to do was invade our democracy and that our way of life, which is something they're playing a long game at, our way of life is in danger right now. And if people understood that, they'd be just as up in arms about what happened during the Cold War. But we know, based on what cyber warfare can do, it's way more powerful than dropping an atom bomb. We're talking about the ability to shut down electrical grids, to stop the water supplies, to literally weaponize it so that you can blow stuff up. I mean, we did it with the Israelis in Stuxnet. Yeah. We blew up centrifuges in Iran. So it can be done.
Yeah.
People have to understand that that's what's involved here and that we are a 241-year-old democracy. We're the beacon to the world. And great societies last anywhere from 250 to 300 years. So we are on a cusp right now. And whether or not we are deciding we're going to uphold the principles of democracy and stand for those institutions which support democracy, like the freedom of the press and equal branches of government, these are the things that we have to fight for now. And people have to understand that that's what's at stake here.
Yeah, and what you said a moment ago about cyber war and what the end game really is with Russia is very similar to what I heard about a week ago when I had a conversation with a cybersecurity expert. He said, it's way worse than we even realize.
Yes.
It's not just about influencing election. It's about sowing seeds of doubt in the process and then convincing our government that we're so unsafe and so vulnerable to cyber attack that we will then get on board with rolling back all kinds of internet freedoms, not just here, but around the world, thus allowing China and Russia to get what they want and be able to roll back freedoms on their own people.
That's exactly right. And there's another aspect of it as well, which is once you start sowing the seeds of doubt in the democracy, you're saying, you know, that way of life isn't the one that works. We have been trying to sell this idea of inclusiveness, of, you know, letting people have freedom of press, of religion, of all of those things that we hold dear. If they can get a wedge in, which they've already done, to make us doubt whether or not our way of life is the better way of life, then you have the European Union, You have NATO dissolved. You have all of those things that have we have put into place to protect our way of life start to crumble. And that's where we are right now. And that's why we have to fight hard against this.
Yeah. Well, going back to LBJ, and one of my favorite aspects of your film is that you don't cheat the viewer out of the bawdier and more entertaining LBJ anecdotes, like conducting meetings from the toilet or the famous call where there's a famous recording of him calling, I think, the Hager Slack Company.
Yeah, trying to buy some slacks. Yeah, and he wants a little extra room, where my nuts hang down, you know, and all that stuff. Those are all taken from... recordings that we had.
I mean, do you think that a man like LBJ would have fared very well today when nothing is off the record anymore and everyone who's around you 24/7 has an iPhone and a social media account?
Well, I mean, it would have been more difficult, but I mean, people are accepting that now. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're okay with Anthony Scaramucci saying what he said, or, you know, you got a president of the United States now who said it's okay to grab a woman's pussy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, if that's okay, then anything's okay. You know, say whatever you want.
I know from talking to your dad, and particularly from his tweets, that he can't stand the president. I kind of tend to think that given the choice between Hitler and Trump, he'd probably want to take a second look at Hitler.
I don't know about that.
What do you think bothers you the most or just completely drives you crazy about Donald Trump?
Well, the thing that bothers me most is that we have somebody who is completely incapable and inept as a president, who's got mental health issues, who is greedy and only cares about himself and not about the country. So it has no business being president. And the fact that he's diminished our standing in the world. There's almost nothing, and I make the joke of the only jobs that he's provided is for comics. I mean, he's made it easier for comics. But other than that, I don't think there's one thing you can recommend about him. Mm-hmm. And even the people who support him, if they actually looked at what he was trying to do, they'd be very angry to know that he was trying to take their health care away. Mm-hmm. Because the people that are disproportionately affected are people in those red states and red districts.
Right, right. Yeah. All those people who voted for him in West Virginia and the coal country.
He's basically against, you know, helping them. And, you know, for him to lie and say, I'm going to bring manufacturing jobs back or bring the coal mining jobs back, it's not going to happen. It won't happen. And so he's not only that, he's a liar, he's self-aggrandizer, he only cares about himself. And it's just very sad that we've gotten to this point in America where a person like that can become the president.
Well, you've always been fairly politically active and vocal about your beliefs, involved and engaged civically. But your movies up till now, with the exception of The American President, have for the most part been apolitical.
Well, that's not true, really.
No, I mean, you don't think so?
Okay. No, because I also did Ghosts of Mississippi.
Right.
And I did A Few Good Men. And now I've done...
Which had a political angle,
Yeah,
sure.
Lyndon Johnson.
Sure.
And now Shock and Awe is a film I just finished.
Right. I was just going to mention that one, too, which I think it covers the journalists in the Iraq War.
Well, it's the run-up to the Iraq War.
Right.
It's the four journalists from the Knight Ridder News Service who got everything right. Mm-hmm. And were completely ignored.
Mm-hmm. So then you don't feel that maybe you're getting a little bit more comfortable with melding your politics and your art. You feel that you've always kind of done
that. You know what I'm getting more comfortable with? Because I know that when I make a movie like Shock and Awe or, you know, LBJ, whatever the movie I'm making that has a political overtone to it, people will hate me for it. They'll hate me because they don't like that I've said these things or whatever. And I'm gotten to the point now where I just want to say what I want to say, you know? And if they don't like me, that's fine. You know, they're allowed to dislike what I have to say. But I, you know, I'm 70 years old now, and, you know, I don't know how many more movies I'm going to make. So I'll make these. And I the other thing is I actually like making movies. So, I mean, you know, I get to do it until somebody says, you can't do this anymore.
I mean, does it bug you when people say, oh, actors and directors, Hollywood people, you know, you just shut up. You can't have a political opinion.
Well, I mean,
what right do you have to voice your opinion?
Well, I
mean,
first of all, everybody has a right to voice their opinion, exactly. But I don't think that people in Hollywood should have any more right than anybody else. And unfortunately, I think they are paid attention to more because they are famous. That's the reason we have Donald Trump as president.
Yeah.
And we have a whole culture now of people who become famous and rich based on nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't have any talents or anything. I would say I'm slightly different from many celebrities in that I've actually held a job in government. I mean, I worked for 7 years to run a state commission in California that oversaw the implementation to early childhood work. And that was, you know, a program that, you know, it generated $500 to $700 million a year for young children. And I oversaw the implementation of that. So I did work in government for 7 years, and I have worked on public policy, and I have been active in getting, you know, I was very involved in overturning Proposition 8, which led the way to marriage equality in America. The group that I helped form, the American Foundation for Equal Rights, was the first group to file a federal lawsuit against, you know, in favor of marriage equality. Mm-hmm. So I have been involved in these things, and I wouldn't talk about something I didn't know anything about. I mean, I think celebrities have certain value in that they can draw attention to a particular issue just by mere fact that they're celebrities. But then I think that it's incumbent upon you, if you want to move the agenda forward in any way, you have to at least steep yourself in that policy and understand what it is you're talking about. So, you know, they can make fun of me, they can say whatever they want, but I actually have done a lot of homework on a lot of these things.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. And you also flirted with running for office yourself back during the recall election. Now that Trump has sort of broken the seal on celebrities being taken seriously as candidates.
Well, I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger was a governor of California, and we've had many celebrities that have been senators, and and you know, Ronald Reagan was a president of the United States.
True.
He was an actor. I mean, we've had people that, you know, Donald Trump, I would say, is the first one who has absolutely no governing experience or any interest in learning about the government or any experience in anything being the president. And he happens to be famous, but he's only famous because of a reality television show. He's not famous for anything else.
Yeah, he's sort of set the standard to where now everyone from Mark Zuckerberg to Kanye West are talking about running in 2020. Do you think that maybe this this might be your moment?
No, I don't think of, I don't think of it that way. I actually want to get things done. I try to get things done. And I try to figure out what's the best way to do it. Is it, is it as an elected official, or is it working? You know, I worked very hard to against Washington Mutual at the time. They owned a piece of land, the Amundsen Ranch, which is in the Santa Monica Mountains, and they wanted to build a city there. And I worked very hard to make that not happen and preserve that land for you know, to be undeveloped. So I work at things, and I want to get something done. I don't think about, oh, I want to be... The only reason to run for office is if you think you can effectuate change or do something in an easier way than what you're doing now. So it doesn't... the idea of being an elected official doesn't hold any interest to me in that way.
Okay. So can you make a Sherman-esque statement about 2020? Or let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Let me put it this way. Do the words President Meathead make you angry
when
or scared?
There was a moment where I did think about running for governor, and it was against Arnold when he ran the second time. And there was those articles, you know, the Terminator versus the Meathead. They did all of those articles. And I make the joke, which was, you know, I did actually seriously consider it at that time because I had spent, like I say, 7 years in California government. And we sat with the family. I have three kids. They were younger at the time. And we talked about it. And I make the joke. It was true, though. I only polled 40% in my own family. So I figured if I couldn't carry my family, then I probably shouldn't do it.
Well, maybe that'll change one day. Well, again, Rob Reiner's film LBJ opens in theaters November 3rd. Rob Reiner, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Rob Reiner for joining me on the podcast. Mark your calendars for his latest film, LBJ, which comes out this November 3rd. And follow Rob Reiner on Twitter at Rob Reiner. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/KickAssNews or click on the donate button at KickAssNews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.